What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X, and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Katie Lambert.
And I'm Sarah Dowdy.
And today we are granting listener requests, fairy godmother style. We've had a lot of requests for this particular subject, but here is a sample email from Lauren of Somerville, South Carolina, who said that she'd listened to our podcast on Rasputin, but I've learned of the youngest Romanov daughter, Anastasia, and the mystery that surrounds her. In 1917, when her family was murdered by the Bolsheviks, they never found Anastasia's body. Did she die, or was she actually Anna Anderson, a German woman who claimed to be Anastasia for her whole life since the murder?
So Candace and Josh did a podcast on Rasputin, How Did Rasputin Really Die? But Lauren's right. That doesn't solve all of the mysteries of the Romanov family.
So first, let's get ourselves a cast of characters. So the family in question, the Romanovs, ruled the Russian Empire from 1613 to 1917. But the guy we're talking about is Nicholas II, who succeeded Alexander III in 1894, and he also married his wife, Alexandra Fyodorovna, the same year.
Together, they have 5 kids, Alexei, Olga, Tatiana, Maria, and Anastasia, who is perhaps the most famous today. Alexei's the baby, and he's the only son, and he's the heir. But he's a hemophiliac, which is something that he inherited from his ancestress, Queen Victoria. So he's not the best heir you could ask for.
But the family is happy with their lot. When Olga was born, the Tsar supposedly said, "I am glad the child is a girl. Had it been a boy, he would have belonged to the people. Being a girl, she belongs to us," which reminded us a lot of Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII.
It may be an apocryphal quote, too. The kind of thing
more
that,
than likely, but it's the kind of thing that's fun to say.
Definitely.
They were a pretty happy family all in all, but as rulers, not so much. In this book, History's Monsters by Simon Sebag Montefiore, he called them inept, cruel, rigid, and obtuse reactionaries, which, you know, ouch.
Yeah, most people agree that Nicholas just wasn't very well suited to his position. He's a timid man, which means that he's easily manipulated and taken advantage of. And Alexandra actually has a lot of power over him, and he has favorites in court who have a lot of power over him. So this makes people uncomfortable.
And he was really out of touch with his own people. He believed in divine right. He had God-given power, so, you know, he did what he wanted because he had God's blessing, and he listened to who he wanted, even if it wasn't maybe the best people. It wasn't the advisors.
The best advice, yeah.
Right. So he decided that anyone who disagreed with him was an enemy, with a capital E, and this does not breed happiness among his subjects.
Yeah, needless to say, Nicholas is very unpopular, and his international relations are a mess. And this all brings us to the Russian Revolution of 1905, which kind of gets this story started.
So in January 1905, the workers of St. Petersburg, which at the time was Petrograd, marched to the Winter Palace with demands for Nicholas. They said that they were still loyal to the Tsar, but that they wanted to elect a legislative assembly.
So even these fairly moderate demands are not met well, and the Tsar's troops fire on them, kill 130, and it's called Bloody Sunday, and it ignites outrage in the Russian people.
By October 1905, there's a general strike. The cities are shutting down because they have no workers, and Nicholas okays a legislative assembly. But don't think the monarchy is giving up that easily. On their side, they have the Black Hundreds, who were counter-revolutionaries and Tsarists, who had access to a lot of arms. They were made mostly of the wealthier class and some clergymen.
And they go after students and left-wingers and have bloody pogroms against the Jews. And they're really not fond of Ukrainians either. So this repressive regime is just getting worse almost.
But the revolutionaries are just as violent. There's a military mutiny and several political assassinations. So you could sum up this whole period with the phrase violent unrest, and this continues for a long time. But with that, we'd like to explain, I guess, why the Romanovs are so interesting. It's not because they're just part of these revolutions.
It's kind of out of touch for standing against the revolution.
No, it's because they're weird.
They're really weird. They're kind of a freaky family.
Alexandra and Nicholas actually had a pretty happy marriage, but everyone else thought they were really bizarre. The Russians hated Alexandra because of her Germanness. Not only was she a German, she also was a haughty, cold kind of person, or at least that's how the people thought of her.
And she epitomized what Russians didn't like in
about Germans. And the First World War didn't help. She was accused of being a spy. And perhaps unsurprisingly, because the people didn't like her, she didn't really like them back and didn't make much of an effort.
So the fact that their only son and heir has hemophilia doesn't really endear Alexandra to her people either. The Russians want a good, strapping, healthy heir. And she has this invalid who she absolutely obsesses over. And she's, of course, blamed for it. And Alexandra, whatever you say about her, she does kind of have a right to obsess over this disorder. It's very serious, and at the time, it was incurable. It's a bleeding disorder where your blood doesn't clot, and some variations can be mild, but in the most serious cases, you bleed internally and into your joints, and it's extremely painful.
So her worries weren't unfounded. You know, this was a really serious thing for her son. But they kept his illness a secret, which probably made things seem very mysterious and very odd.
Yeah, people would just wonder what was going on and also why this child was being coddled so much.
So they were always looking for ways to cure him. And when medicine failed him, the mystic Rasputin entered their lives, who supposedly could heal little Alexei. And we won't go into this story too much because of the other podcast. But Rasputin had a lot of power over the Romanovs and was a very strange and possibly evil man. He was murdered in 1916 after several attempts to kill him, but he wouldn't die, much like a cartoon character.
Yeah, he keeps having that anvil fall on his head.
And surviving.
So just to add to this rather damning case against the Tsar and his wife, people also think Nicholas II was impotent and Alexandra was a lesbian and that she had had sex with Rasputin to get her children. So there's just so much wrapped up around this couple.
And also that all the daughters were having sex with Rasputin. And people had no idea, again, what was really going on in that palace, but as far as outward appearances go, they thought something was entirely out of whack. So again, behind all of this, the revolutions are still happening. The revolution of 1905 did not end in 1905, and neither did that unrest.
The players change.
Exactly. So then we have the Russian Revolution of 1917. And the government is very corrupt. Everyone hates the Tsar at this point. He's blamed for all the things he has done and the things he hasn't done. And it's also become very clear during the war that while the rest of Europe has been modernizing, Russia has not.
That's something we talked about a little in our Crimean War episode. They were realizing that even then.
It's especially clear to the army, which is falling apart during warfare. But there's also a food shortage, which is when the rioting started. And in this climate, Nicholas abdicated in March. His brother wouldn't take the throne. I wouldn't either if I'd been his brother. And the Romanovs are done. They have fallen completely out of power in the Russian Empire.
So there's a power grab that happens. And to really simplify something that's quite complicated, the Bolsheviks and the left socialist revolutionaries are the winners. And the Bolsheviks promise peace, land, and bread, which sounds like a pretty good deal.
You can understand. You can't argue with that.
How no. People would get behind that.
So back to our family. Nicholas, of course, abdicated after the February Revolution, which was part one of the revolution of 1917. So now what? The family's on house arrest for 5 months in Alexander Palace, but in August 1917, they're sent to Tobolsk, Siberia.
And the Bolsheviks have a fateful decision to make at this point. Exile the royal family or kill them, kill the Tsar. And the family is a symbol, and because symbols are so important, you can see why this would be such a momentous decision. If you exile the family, they can always come back. You can have grandchildren come back. Mm-hmm. It can go on for centuries.
So in April 1918, they're still wavering on what to do, and they summon Nicholas away. Alexandra and Maria go with him to Ekaterinburg and the Urals, and the rest of the family doesn't join until May because Alexei was too sick to go before. And this is a big change for the royal family. There's not a lot of food. They're dressed in rags. They're not treated well. They're imprisoned in this house and don't have a lot to do. They spend a lot of time reading the Bible.
And in July 1918, a man named Yakov Sverdlov signs off on the killing of the Romanov family. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, a group of men come for the Romanovs, and the family, along with a few of their servants who had remained loyal to them and their doctor, are taken into a small room and shot to death. And according to Robert Massey's The Romanovs, the final chapter, those who don't die in the first round of shots, which are the girls, are then bayoneted. Alexei is shot in the ear. Anastasia's maid is bayoneted 30 times after she survives the gunshots and tries to escape. And the family's also disfigured. They're hit in the face with rifle butts. And Anastasia's dog is even killed. So just this really violent assassination of the family.
Yeah, you have to picture this group, I think, 12 executioners, and then this family of nine in this teeny tiny room and all the blood. So the bloody, disfigured bodies were brought to a place called the Four Brothers, which was north of Ekaterinburg, and a place of swamps and peat bogs and mines. And when the bodies were stripped, the men found that the Romanov daughters had diamonds sewn into their corsets, which explained why the bullets weren't killing them, the jewels were deflecting them.
Which is something I remember learning about when I was a kid and just being fascinated by this story.
Always keep diamonds in your clothes, Sarah, always.
The original Kevlar.
They were also wearing amulets with Rasputin's picture on them. Again, this is all according to Massey's book. And the bodies were thrown down a mine shaft with grenades thrown after them.
And by July 18th, it was announced at a meeting where Lenin was present that Nicholas had been executed, but that Alexandra and the children were safe. And this, it turns out to be a lie, because Lenin knew about the executions before they happened, knew about the executions of the whole family.
Yes, this was kept up for a long time, that Lenin had no idea what was going on, but it was all signed off on long before.
Yeah.
So on the 20th, the papers announced the death of Nicholas, but again, his family was reported to be alive. It wasn't until much later that the world found out that they were dead.
So about a week after the executions, the counter-revolutionaries, the whites, capture Ekaterinburg, and obviously search for the Romanovs, can't find them, but they do find their blood. And by January 1919, a real search has been launched at Four Brothers by the whites.
And they find little bits of jewelry, buckles, glasses case, a finger, but no bodies. So where are they? And around the same time or shortly thereafter, there start to be rumors that some of the royal family has indeed escaped. A woman named Anna Anderson claims that she is Anastasia and she made it out alive. And there are several other Anastasia imposters that pop up over the years.
Yeah, Anastasia somehow becomes the central figure of this story.
But back to our question of the bodies. Word got out about where they'd been buried after they'd been buried. So one of the executioners went and moved them, and they remained a secret for a very long time until someone found that same man's diary much later and pieced together where they might be. In 1991, 9 bodies were discovered in the area. They were assumed to be Nicholas, Alexandra, 3 of the kids, their doctor, and 3 servants, which leaves us with 2 kids unaccounted for who were assumed to be Alexei and Anastasia. And in 1998, it was confirmed with DNA evidence that those were the Romanovs.
And so the Romanov bones were buried in St. Petersburg, and there was a lot of controversy about this, about the burial. The church objected to it because it didn't recognize that these were the Romanovs' remains, and their names weren't said during the service, and a lot of people didn't buy the story that these were the Romanov bones. And in 2004, another study came out, and this group, also using DNA evidence, said that there was no way that these bodies could be the Romanov bones.
Right. They thought the DNA evidence had been contaminated, and so you couldn't say with any certainty that that's who they were.
So we have our story debunked just a little over a decade later.
And in 2007, 2 more bodies were found, and these were positively identified as Alexei and one of the girls. The people who did this study said it was virtually irrefutable evidence.
And all these bodies, by the way, are found around the Four Brothers area.
As a result of these studies, we basically have 3 camps. So the first one, all the Romanovs were killed, and we found all of their remains.
So the 1991 bodies, the real deal. And the 2007 bodies, the real deal.
Everything's completely buttoned up. The second camp, all the Romanovs were killed, but we need more studies to find out if what we have is the real deal.
And maybe we have some of the real bodies and we don't have others.
Yes, I'm in the second camp, for the record. And the third camp was that some of the Romanovs escaped and went on to live lives elsewhere. But the woman we mentioned before, Anna Anderson, who's the most famous Anastasia imposter, really was an imposter. Mitochondrial DNA tests were done after her death, and it doesn't match at all the Romanovs.
In 1977, the Apatiev house, where the Romanovs spent their last days, was demolished with a wrecking ball. And Yeltsin actually did it under Brezhnev's orders because it was still a place of pilgrimage. It was still a place where people went to, celebrate the
secretly the monarchists. In 2000, the Romanovs were named Holy Passion Bearers by the Russian Orthodox Church. And it's kind of like being martyrs, but martyrs are people who die for their faith, whereas passion bearers are people who still show great faith in the face of death.
But our sort of interesting concluding point here, the big about face, is that in 2008, the Russian Supreme Court ruled that the Romanovs were victims of political repression. Before that, I think people were focusing on the murders as just a random act, not a government-directed act. So it was a big step to admit
that they were
assassinated.
Right.
Exactly.
And in 1999, a distant descendant of the Romanovs, I think he was an ancestor of Nicholas I, actually, told Newsweek, here's a pretty long quote for you. There was a certain logic to the murders from the Bolshevik point of view. Reaction to the revolution was still strong. They were being attacked from all sides, so destroying the Tsar, a symbolic figurehead, committed all those who participated in the revolution to an irreversible course. It's terrible to say it, but I understand their logic. It would have been too dangerous to leave the Tsar alive. But how they did it was a different matter. They murdered the family with the utmost barbarity, then tried to cover up the fate of the family and tried to pretend it was a local decision. It set the tone for future secretive state terror. And that's the final word on the Romanovs. But if you have some ideas on what you think happened to them, email us at historypodcast@howstuffworks.com. And if you'd like to learn more about their creepy mystic, you should check out our article, How Did Rasputin Really Die? But that brings us to listener mail.
So we have another comment for you on our Satchel Paige episode. This is from Brian in New York, and it was left on the blogs. he wrote, after we said that Satchel reportedly pitched at up to 105 miles per hour, he wrote, 105 miles per hour? The highest recorded speed in recent history is 104.8, and that's in an era where pitchers take much better care of their arms, and even that one is widely acknowledged to be inflated, as it's 1.8 miles per hour higher than any other recorded pitch. The highest number I could find for Page is 103, which is probably at or just beyond his actual one-pitch-in-a-lifetime top speed, at which, given the circumstances under which he was playing, is certainly so stupefyingly impressive that it doesn't need embellishment. I wouldn't believe it if someone told me Paul Bunyan threw 105. So we thought that was pretty funny.
So thank you for the clarification, Brian. If anyone else has anything to say about it, feel free to email us. We're also on Twitter if you'd like to follow us at Missed in History. And again, you should check out our Rasputin article on our homepage at www.howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. And be sure to check out the Stuff You Missed in History Class blog on the HowStuffWorks.com homepage.
I'm going out with the girls this weekend. Nails done. Outfit stunner. And my skin? I know it's going to be glowing because I glammed up my shower routine with new Olay Indulgent Moisture Body Wash. It smells so luxurious and deeply moisturizes with its super rich, creamy lather that's bursting with vitamin B3 complex. So my skin glows and my confidence grows. Try new Olay Indulgent Moisture Body Wash for glowing skin in just 14 days.
Happy Pride from Tomboy X. We just dropped our Pride 24 collection. Queer founded, queer run, and creating size and gender inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. So you feel comfortable in your own skin. Visit TomboyX.com to shop.
You wouldn't expect to hear that we're America's third best city for beer like this one. Or home to vibes like this. And this. It might surprise you that we're top 10 for immersive art that's like,
whoa.
And, not to mention, we have one of the top zoos in the country. So can a city with the country's best pro soccer team, ranking as a top culinary destination in the world, be in your own backyard? Yes, Columbus. Plan your summer at experiencecolumbus.com/summer.
Have you ever wondered what it would be like to have supervision, enhanced hearing, extraordinary reflexes, to be, dare we say, superhuman? Well, Roku's new Pro Series TV can't do any of that for you. But with a 4K screen, side-firing speakers, and a blazing fast refresh rate, it'll sure feel like it. Elevate your entertainment using all your favorite apps like iHeart and play all your music, radio, and podcasts with the new Roku Pro Series. Your senses aren't better. Your TV is.